From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! In the aftermath of the Democratic National Convention, we'll hear different views on the political process. Lonnie Guinier on proportional representation, and writer Gore Vidal will share his letter to the next president of the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Norwegian divers said today they believe all of the 118 crew of Russia's stricken submarine Kursk are dead after opening an inside hatch and discovering the main part was flooded. Norwegian officials said they believe any further attempt at a rescue operation is hopeless and should be called off. The Norwegian announcement was the final crushing blow to relatives of the men who, despite official Russian statements, most of the crew had probably died following an accident 9 days ago, had held out slim hopes some might have survived. International arms sales surged last year to nearly $30.3 billion, the highest level since 1996, and the United States solidified its position as the world's biggest arms dealer. This, according to a government report by the Congressional Research Service, an arm of the Library of Congress. It shows that American contractors sold nearly $11.8 billion in weapons in 1999, more than a third of the world's total, and more than all European countries combined. A majority of Verizon communications workers are expected back on the job today. The company has settled a contract dispute with unions representing about 50,000 employees, but it's still working on an agreement with about 35,000 workers in the Mid-Atlantic region. Verizon reached agreement yesterday with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and one of two bargaining unions for the Communications Workers of America, covering employees in New York and New England. Verizon officials say workers will get a 12% raise over the 3 years' life of the contract, better benefits, and improved job security. New Mexico's Governor Gary Johnson toured the site of Saturday's deadly natural gas pipeline explosion. Investigators are searching for the cause of the blast that killed 10 campers and critically burned two others. A dozen people from two families were camping at the site near the Pecos River when an underground pipeline 500 feet away ruptured, creating a huge fireball. Federal investigators say the heat was so intense that sand was turned into glass and part of a concrete bridge structure turned into powder. The pipeline company, El Paso Energy, says the pipeline was installed in 1950 and was last checked August 2nd. This international news, the opposition candidate for governor of the southern Mexican state of Chiapas claimed victory last night after an historic vote toppled the long-ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as PRI, in one of its strongholds, just weeks after it lost its 71-year grip on the Mexican presidency. Chiapans poured into the streets to celebrate after the state electoral board said independent Senator Pablo Salazar led with 55% of the vote. The results echoed July 2nd elections when an opposition presidential candidate beat the PRI for the first time in Mexico's history. One of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak's top aides resigned today, the second confidant to quit in a week amid complaints the Israeli leader ignores advice and fails to delegate responsibility. The resignation of the chief of staff of the prime minister's office is the latest sign that Barak's government is in trouble. Last month, Barak lost his parliamentary majority, with hawkish parties quitting the coalition in protest over concessions to the Palestinians in peace talks. Observers say early elections are likely after parliament reconvenes in late October. This news from Indonesia. In a The former ruler, Suharto, will face trial next week on charges of corruption during his long autocratic rule. South Jakarta chief judge told reporters the trial would start in the last days of August at the latest. Meanwhile, in Aceh, still no word on the Achenese human rights lawyer, Jafar Sadiq Hamza. He is from the United States, living in New York for many years, went back to help people in his homeland of Aceh, where over the last decade, thousands of Achenese have been killed by the Indonesian military. Two Saturdays ago, he no longer was in contact with his family, though he was supposed to be calling them every 2 hours. And since that time, he has not been heard from. Phone calls continue to pour into the U.S. State Department, demanding that the Indonesian military do an accounting of him. And police are bracing for an attempt by thousands of political activists to disrupt a World Economic Forum conference in Australia next month with a Seattle-style protest demonstration. The World Economic Forum, known as WEF, to be held in Melbourne's Crown Casino from September 11th to 13th, will be attended by government officials and economic leaders from around the world, including the world's richest man, Microsoft chief Bill Gates.
I tired of marching, I tired protesting, I tired of talking, I tired of resting. My brothers still dying, my mothers them crying, while the top dog laughing. I telling you,
it will never change.
Tell them,
it will never change.
Oh yeah,
it will never change.
Oh Lord,
until we do something about it, it will never change.
Till We Do Something About It, sung by Sam Archer on his CD, The Return. Here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Before we move on with the main body of our show, a letter that Gore Vidal reads to the next president of the United States, and a speech given by Lonnie Guinier on proportional representation, we're going out to Boulder, Colorado. This weekend, hundreds of people protested the 50th anniversary of the Aspen Institute. James Wolfensohn, head of the World Bank, was there. Henry Kissinger was scheduled to speak, but was replaced by New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. The Aspen Institute has been deeply involved in U.S. foreign policy issues for decades. We go now to Nell Geiser, who is an intern at Democracy Now! With us at both the Republican and Democratic conventions, then took a caravan back from Los Angeles and went to this protest. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nell.
Thanks, Amy.
Nell, by the way, is one of the many thousands of young people who've participated in protests from Washington, D.C., the World Bank, IMF protests, as well as organized her own zine in Boulder, Colorado, in her high school called Co-Motion. So, Nell, tell us what happened this weekend.
Well, there were protests both Saturday and Sunday outside of the 50th anniversary summit that the Aspen Institute put together. It was looking at globalization and the human condition. It brought together a whole host of luminaries in various fields, policymakers, Nobel Peace Prize winners, journalists, various kinds of people to discuss these issues. But the problem was that protesters had with this summit was that, for one thing, it cost $750 to get in to be an audience member, and for another, these high-level policymakers and leaders, world leaders, were not discussing the many problems that we as a grassroots movement as, and as people affected by corporate globalization around the world have with the direction that corporate globalization is taking right now. So what happened this past weekend was very, very successful and definitely declared a victory for activist forces, should be a victory for activist forces everywhere. A new local organizing group in the mountains, calling themselves Mountain Folks for Global Justice, created an alternative people summit on globalization, alternatives to a corporate vision. And they organized a teach-in and march on Saturday in the spirit of the anti-corporate globalization protests of Seattle, Washington, D.C. in April, and also the protests at the Democratic and Republican conventions this summer. In fact, as you mentioned, the protests did draw activists returning from L.A. in caravans as well as from Denver and the Front Range. About 250 people marched Saturday, along with Kevin Danaher from Global Exchange, who spoke at the teach-in, Peter Hart from FAIR, Najoki Jehu from 50 Years is Enough, various other folks who came to look at the many issues involved in this process of wealth distribution to the top and corporate globalization. So this action involved marching through the town and to the Aspen Institute, actually getting close to the Aspen Institute, marching. About 50 of us marched through the parking lot and got closer to the tent. So James Wolfensohn, the president of the World Bank, who was speaking at that point, giving the keynote on the first night, could hear us loud and clear talking about the protesters were talking about the problems with the World Bank. And then we had a fair amount of media attention, and the next day came back to the next summit, the next workshop called Globalization and Its Discontents, and made sure that that they raised the discontents.
Is it true that participants in the Aspen Institute's 50th anniversary event wear togas?
Well, I don't think they were wearing togas this week, Amy, but the business executives who come up for week-long workshops at this venerable Aspen institution do continue to wear togas for a couple days of their stay. They don them to remind them, I guess, of the times of Socrates that they're studying, looking at the great masters as well as the issues of the day. And I'm not sure if Wolfensohn and Friedman were wearing togas, but it's possible.
Well, now we have to wrap up as we move on to Lonnie Guinier, but any final words about this protest? And were there others who were your age? I mean, we're talking about protests all over the country that are increasingly drawing young people, not only from college, but like you, from high school.
Yes, there were quite a few high school students and many college students. It was a very multi-generational experience, and it was quite ironic that it was held in the city of Aspen with some of the greatest beneficiaries of globalization, where they spend their leisure time. The average house there costs $3.5 million. Workers in Aspen can't afford to live there. So we really wanted to bring out the fact that the beneficiaries of globalization and those speaking at this summit we're not paying attention to the grassroots voices and to the voices that are not listened to in this process. And so we have the Mountain Folks of Global Justice charged us $750 to get into their People Summit because I couldn't afford to pay $750.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Nell Geiser. Her zine is called Commotion, speaking to us from Boulder, Colorado. Well, we are now going to move on to other events that have taken place throughout the Democratic Convention and beyond, and the aftermath of the coronations in Philadelphia and Los Angeles, known more popularly as the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. We wanted to turn to some excerpts from a town hall meeting held in Los Angeles last week, sponsored by the Nation Institute. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Gore Vidal reading his open letter to the next president of the United States. But first, we turn to a speech by Lonnie Guinier on proportional representation. 7 years ago, she was President Clinton's nominee as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. There was an intense media smear campaign against her. She was dubbed the quota queen. Eventually, without even being able to clear her name or have hearings, President Clinton withdrew her nomination. One of the most prominent themes of the attack on Guinier was her supposed support for electoral districts shaped to ensure a black majority, a process known as race-conscious districting. An entire op-ed piece in the New York Times, which appeared on the day her nomination was withdrawn, was based on the premise that Guinier was in favor of, quote, segregating black voters in black majority districts. In reality, Guinier is one of the most prominent voices in the civil rights community challenging such districting. With the Green Party and Ralph Nader fighting to get into the debates, here is Lonnie Guinier.
I want to talk about the next 12 years, not the next 4 months. And I want to talk about the next 12 years because I think that part of the problem in the way that we tend to examine problems is that we look at them only in terms of what we can do today, as opposed to how can we build toward tomorrow. This is about the future, not just the present. If we were going to talk only about the present, I would start by talking about Bill Gates. And I would tell you, for example, that the top 1% of U.S. households now have more wealth than the entire bottom 95%, but that Bill Gates alone has more wealth than the bottom 45% of American households combined. Bill Gates in 1998, that was 2 years ago, his billion-dollar wealth was worth more than the GNPs of all of Central America, plus Jamaica and Belize. One man. We call this in the United States affluenza. And we promote the idea that this is the American dream and everyone can have access to it, when in fact only 4% of millionaires have come from poverty. This is the American dream that a few experience. And if I were just going to talk about the present, I would also talk about the other American dream that more than 2 million of our fellow citizens are presently experiencing, and that is the present drive to incarcerate more and more of our young people, particularly African American and Latino men. We have 458,000 people in United States prisons on drug charges alone. That is more than 100,000 people in prison in the entire European Union. Okay, so we have 458,000 people incarcerated on drug charges alone. It's more than 100,000 people imprisoned in the entire European Union, and they have a population that is more than 100 million larger than ours. Now, one-third of black men between the ages of 18 and 34 are under the supervision of the criminal justice system. For every one black man in college in California, there are five in a state penitentiary. For every one Latino man in California in college, there are three in prison. Blacks make up 46% of all inmates serving sentences of at least 1 year. And I could give you an analysis of why I think this is happening. It's part of the war on drugs. It's part of a failed policy that has been pushed by both the Republican and the Democratic administrations.
Harvard University law professor Lonnie Guinier will continue with this speech in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we go back to the speech of Harvard Law professor Lonnie Guinier talking about what she calls the disaster of politics in this country.
Politicians of all stripes know that the war on drugs has been a failure, and yet they are intimidated by the charge that they are soft on crime to follow what they know is rational and to educate the American people that we need to treat drugs as a public health problem, not a criminal justice problem. And part of the reason that we need to reconsider the war on drugs is because the drive to incarcerate so many people is draining our state budgets. California used to have the premier higher education system in this country, and in 1995, California started spending more money building prisons than building institutions of higher education. Right now in California, a first-year college professor makes $41,000 a year. A prison guard makes $51,000 a year. So those of you who have been teaching in college, you now know what you should be doing. So what do we do about this? If the politicians are too intimidated from speaking the truth, who is going to speak the truth to the American people so that we can begin to invest in our children and not in the prison industrial complex? I say until we change the political system in this country, no one is going to be able to speak truth to power. And that is because we have basically sold our democracy to the highest bidder. And we have sold our democracy not because we're bad people, but because the structure of our political system demands it. Everyone that has been on this panel who is a politician has spoken of the need to move to the center. Why do you have to move to the center in politics? You don't have to move to the center in democracy. You have to move to the center in America's version of democracy. This is simply a choice, a preference that we have made based on our legacy of British rule. We have adopted a system called winner-take-all elections, meaning that whoever gets the most votes wins all the power, and whoever votes for the loser, whether it is George W. Bush or Ralph Nader, gets nothing. Why do we give the loser no power? Why do we give those who dissent no voice? Because the politicians like it that way. The politicians who have been successful are those who have figured out where the votes lie and have oriented themselves to capture the middle. Most other democracies use a system called proportional representation. What does proportional representation mean? Proportional representation does not mean quotas. Let me say that again. Proportional representation does not mean quotas. Proportional representation means democracy. Proportional representation means when you vote, whoever you vote for becomes your representative. Amazing. You actually get to choose who represents you. You actually get to choose who speaks for you. My 7 minutes is up. But let me just close by saying, we need a democracy that is not just of and by and for the people. We need a democracy that is with the people. If you want a democracy that speaks not only for you but with you, you need the power to be able to cast a vote for someone who can then get elected to represent you. We need to think globally but act locally. And we can change the system of elections in this country within the next 12 years because there is nothing in the Constitution that says we have to vote based on winner-take-all elections. The Constitution is absolutely silent on this subject. The Constitution does not say you have to divide up congressional seats into districts. We could elect members of Congress by voting for a political party, and then based on the number of votes that party got, they would get that percentage of votes in the Congress. So the Green Party, even if it could not win the presidency, could be represented in the Congress from California. The advantage of the system, which has been used in Illinois for half of this century, which was used in New York City with great success during the 1940s, is that it maximizes turnout because it gives every politician an incentive to bring out the voters who actually support the views of that politician or that party. This is not about the lesser of two evils. This is about maximizing choice, which I always thought in America was our greatest value. Thank you very much.
Harvard University law professor Lonnie Guinier speaking last week at a Nation Institute forum at the Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Last week, MasterCard Credit Company filed a $5 million lawsuit against Ralph Nader, accusing him of ripping off MasterCard's well-known priceless advertising campaign in a new TV ad for the Green Party presidential candidate. MasterCard filed its lawsuit in Manhattan, seeking an order barring Nader from running the ad. MasterCard's ads feature sentimental episodes of families together at places including a beach or baseball game, assigning monetary values to various activities before coming up with an activity that is priceless. The ads conclude there's some things in life money can't buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard. Well, the Nader ad adopts a nearly identical format to focus attention on the role of political contributions in this year's presidential campaign. The ad opens with video clips of Texas Governor George Bush and Vice President Al Gore as an announcer intones grilled tenderloin for fundraiser, $1,000 a plate. Campaign ads filled with half-truths, $10 million. Promises to special interest groups, over $10 billion. Finding out the truth, priceless. The announcer concludes, there are some things money can't buy. Without Ralph Nader in the presidential debates, the truth will come in last. Well, in the spirit of that, we bring you a speech at the Nation Institute Forum by Gore Vidal. Gore Vidal was born at West Point and raised in Washington, D.C. He was the grandson of the legendary Senator Thomas Gore and kin to Jimmy Carter, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and Vice President Al Gore. Vidal is well known for novels like Burr, Lincoln, 1876, and Empire. In 1960, he ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Congress as a Democratic liberal candidate in New York. Between 1970 and 72, he was co-chair of the People's Party. In 1982, Gore Vidal launched a campaign in California for the U.S. Senate, where he ran against Pete Wilson. He came second out of a field of nine, polling 500,000 votes. Well, this past week, at the Town Hall Forum at the Leo Beck Temple, he read his letter to the future president of the United States.
Well, as Ronald Reagan would say, okay. Always eloquent. For 50 years, I was the only Gore. I've been sitting here all day reeling as this name of my cousin is bandied about. I don't know how to respond. If I were younger, would I turn green with envy? I am in Cassandra mode today. And recently, another magazine keeps asking me to write for them. Modern Maturity. I think many of you can see why. It is visible. So I have indeed written, they asked, would you write for, I think it's the November issue, a letter to the next president of the United States, whoever he might be. So this is what I've done. It's advice. Good morning, Mr. President. It's January 2001 again. Yes, again, we were there once before. Remember? In 1968 with Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. Unfortunately, our current 2001 involves space not as a place to explore, but as a busy firing range where we intend to knock out the incoming nuclear missiles of a fiendishly resourceful, if as yet unidentified, enemy who daily grows more fearsome. Who might he be? Hard to tell. Once the Soviet Union so unsportingly disbanded, in order to pursue proto-capitalism and double-entry bookkeeping, our warlords have been anxiously searching for new enemies in order to justify an ever-increasing military budget. Obviously, there is terrorism, which is all around us, and there is the war on drugs, which is really all around us, and so never to be won. Now, in a burst of inspiration, a new, clear, and present danger has been unveiled. States of concern, formerly rogue states, currently North Korea, Iraq, Iran, have been so fingered. Meanwhile, the world's 1 billion Muslims are being demonized as wild fanatics dedicated to destroying all that is good on earth, which is us. So now that we have literally targeted our enemies, we can be certain that sooner or later they will take out our cities from their outer spaceships. Therefore, to protect ourselves, the Ronald Reagan Memorial Nuclear Space Shield must be set in place at an initial cost of $60 billion, even though, as of last July, tests of component parts, no matter how faked by the Pentagon, kept failing. All told, from 1946 to 1999, the United States has spent on national defense $7.1 trillion. Since our national debt is now $3.6 trillion, we should note that all of this is due to military spending and to the servicing of the debt thus incurred. Since Treasury figures are always juggled, we will be in your debt, Mr. President, whoever you might be, if you see to it that the actual income and outgo of federal money is honestly reported. Last year, the government told us falsely that its income was just over $1.8 trillion, while it spent, the first time ever, just under $1.8 trillion. Hence the famous phantom surplus, when there was actually the usual homely deficit of around $90 billion. Year after year, the government's official income is inflated by counting as revenue the income of the people's Social Security and Medicare trust funds. These funds are not federal revenue. Last year, Social Security had a surplus of $150 billion. No wonder corporate America and their employees in Congress want to privatize this healthy fund, which is endangered only by them. Although actual military spending was indeed lower last year than usual, half the budget still went to pay for wars to come, as well as to blowing up the odd aspirin factory in the Sudan. Cash outlays for the military were $344 billion, while interest on the military caused national debt was $282 billion. I'm sorry to bore you with these statistics, Mr. President, but they are at the heart of our, what was Jimmy Carter's unfortunate word, malaise, which is French for broke. Despite the administration's recent airy promise of a $1.9 trillion budget surplus over the next decade, Mr. President, if you're going to be of any use to us at all, the nation or the globe that it uneasily holds hostage, you will have to tame, and here comes the Cassandra part, the American military. Cut back on their revenues, particularly for weapons procurement. Discipline the out-of-control service chiefs. A permanent bureaucrat at the Department of Defense remarked recently, "I would never let the services talk to me the way this leadership, the Clinton administration, is letting the services talk to them." In August 1961, I visited President Kennedy at Hyannisport. The Berlin Wall was going up, and he was about to begin a big military buildup. Reluctantly, or so he said, as he puffed on a cigar liberated by a friend from Castro's Cuba. Operation Mongoose was never very thorough. It should be noted in passing that Jack hated liberals more than he did conservatives. He used to say, "No one can ever be liberal enough for the New York Post." This was a different era, of course. Well, he said, "The New York Post should be happy now. Berlin's going to cost us at least $3.5 billion. So with this military buildup, we're going to have a $7 billion deficit this year." "It's a lot of pump priming," said Kennedy. And then he scowled. He said, "I hate the way that they throw money around over there at the Pentagon." "It's not they," I said primly. "It's you now. It's your administration." He told me the facts of life, and I repeat them now, Mr. President, as advice from the 35th to the, what number are you, Mr. President? Are you 42 or 43? "The only way," said Kennedy, "for a president to control the Pentagon would be if he spent the entire 4 years of his first term doing nothing else but investigating that mess, which means he really could do nothing else." "Like getting elected," I added. He grinned, something like that. "So I now propose, while there is still time, that the new president zero in on the links between corporate America and the military and rationalize as best you can the various procurement policies, particularly the Ronald Reagan Memorial Nuclear Shield, sometimes known as National Missile Defense, or NMD. You should also leak to the American people certain Pentagon secrets. In 1995, we still had our missiles trained on 2,500 foreign targets. Today, to celebrate peace in the world, our missiles are trained on 3,000 foreign targets, of which 2,260 are in Russia, while the other targets are in China, already selected as our next world enemy, and of course, targets in the rogue states of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Although President Clinton has spoken eloquently of a reduction in such dangerous nuclear targeting, the Pentagon goes its merry way, making the world unsafe for everyone.
Gore Vidal speaking last week in Los Angeles in the midst of the Democratic National Convention. We'll continue with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with Gore Vidal's open letter to the next president of the United States.
Jack Kennedy very much enjoyed a book called 7 Days in May by Fletcher Nebel, a journalist of that time, later became a movie. It tells how the military, under a jingo based on one Admiral Arthur Radford, plan a coup to take over the White House. This was very much Jack's kind of book. He found it riveting. Only he chuckled, it's a lot more likely that this president will one day raise his own army and occupy their damned building. No, I don't agree with Oliver Stone that the generals killed him. But there is somewhere out there, and this is what is missing in our history, a watchdog that seems never to bark in the night. Yet the dog that doesn't bark is the one that should be guarding the house from burglars. In this case, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower famously warned us about. Yes, there are numerous media stories about costly overruns in the defense industries, and there's the beginning of what might turn into an actual debate over the nuclear shield that Reagan envisaged for us after having seen Alfred Hitchcock's Torn Curtain, a movie nowhere near as good as 2001. Frances Fitzgerald tells us this wondrous story in her book Way Out There in the Blue. But no one has yet taken seriously the military's ongoing threat to us all, thanks to the hubris of senior officers grown accustomed to dispensing vast amounts of the people's money for missiles that can't hit targets and bombers that cannot fly in the rain. Congress, which should ride herd, does not because too many of its members are financed by those same companies that absorb our tax money. Nor is it particularly helpful that senior officers, after placing orders with the defense industry, often go to work as salesmen for the very same companies that they used to buy from. Of all recent presidents, Clinton was expected to behave sensibly in economic matters. He understood how the economy works, but because he had used various dodges to stay out of Vietnam, he came to office worried that he would be thought weak by the military. When Clinton chose to live up to a pledge to gay voters by ensuring that the private life of any military person was no business but his own, the chiefs began to howl that morale would be destroyed. Clinton backed down. When a major general insulted him in a speech, he did nothing. fortunately, others removed the general. When Clinton went aboard the battleship Roosevelt to take the salute, sailors pranced around with mop ends on their heads, doing fag imitations while hooting at the president. This was aboard the Roosevelt. Clinton just stood there. I can only say that if Franklin D. Roosevelt, the commander-in-chief that I served under in World War II, had been so treated, at least one admiral would have been peeling potatoes in the galley the next day, while 100 sailors would be enjoying quiet time in the brig. These successful insults to civilian authority has made the military ever more truculent and insolent, and now they must be brought to heel. Last summer, the warlords of the Pentagon presented the Secretary of Defense with their program objective memorandum. Usually, this is a polite wish list of things that they would like to see under the Christmas tree. But last summer's wish list turned out to be a harsh ultimatum. As one dissenting officer put it, instead of a budget based on a top-line budget number, the chiefs are demanding a budget based on military strategy. Although their joint military strategies, as tested in war over the last 50 years, have usually been disastrous, military strategy in this context simply means extorting from the government $30 billion a year over and above the 51% of the budget that now already goes for war. Mr. President, I would advise you to move your office from the West Wing of the White House to the Pentagon across the river. Better view, even though every day that you spend there could prove to be your Ides of March. You will at least have the satisfaction of knowing that you tried to do something for us, the hitherto unrepresented people. 50 years ago, Harry Truman replaced the old republic with a national security state whose sole purpose is to wage, as the historian Charles Beard put it, perpetual war for perpetual peace. Representative government of, by, and for the people is a faded memory, as you all have been discussing today. Only corporate America enjoys representation by the Congresses and presidents that it pays for in an arrangement where no one is entirely accountable because those who have bought the government also own the media. Now, with the revolt of... Now, with the revolt of the Praetorian Guard at the Pentagon, we are entering a new and dangerous phase. Although we regularly stigmatize other societies as rogue states, we ourselves have become the largest rogue state of all. We honor no treaties. We spurn international courts. We strike unilaterally wherever we choose. We give orders to the United Nations, but do not pay our dues. Complaining of terrorism, our empire is now the greatest terrorist of all. We bomb, invade, subvert other states. Although we, the people of the United States, are the sole source of legitimate authority in this land, we are no longer represented in Congress assembled. Our Congress has been hijacked by corporate America and its enforcer, the imperial military machine. We, the unrepresented people of the United States, are as much victims of this militarized government as any Panamanian or Iraqi or Somalian. We have allowed our institutions to be taken over in the name of a globalized American empire that is totally alien in concept to anything our founders had in mind. I suspect that it is far too late in the day for us to restore the republic that we lost a half century ago. Also, as Pericles reminded the Athenians, there is an off chance that you might actually make some difference in an empire is also a very dangerous thing to let go. So, Mr. President, if you want to make some difference, start now to rein in the warlords. Reduce military spending, which will make you popular because you can then reduce our taxes instead of doing what you have been financed to do, freeing corporate America of its tiny tax burden. Finally, as sure as you were not elected by we the people, but by vast sums of unaccountable corporate money, the day of judgment is approaching. So be like Teddy Roosevelt. The bosses of New York said, "We bought him, but he didn't stay bought." Use your first term to break the Pentagon. Forget about a second term. Because should you succeed on the other side of the Potomac, you will be here, a hero to we the people. Should you fail, or worse, do nothing, you could be the last president, by which time history will have ceased to notice. The United States and all our proud rhetoric will have been reduced to an ever diminishing echo. Let us try not to let this happen.
Writer Gore Vidal. His letter to the next president of the United States here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And at that nation forum, one of the last people to speak was Lori Wallach. Yes, the media coverage of the protests at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles last week was nothing new. We saw it or didn't see it in Philadelphia as well. Demonstrators are shown but seldom heard. Lori Wallach gives voice to some of those voices. She's with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
What is energizing the street protesters here in L.A. and has in other major cities? Globalization and corporate rule. And around the world, globalization and corporate rule. What is the common denominator building the most diverse coalition of progressive activism in this country and around the world in decades? What puts together small businesses, workers, environmentalists, consumer activists, environmentalists? It's fighting corporate rule. What links our current Democratic and Republican presidential candidates and the Wall Street branch of the Republicans and the DLC Republican branch of, I use that advisedly, the Democratic Party? It's fealty to that corporate rule. And there is an array of issues on which these parties have been grabbed by the corporations. And globalization is the one that, in its enormity, stands to undermine the issues that actually make for real differences between the Democratic and Republican parties on health care, on education, on the environment. But it's a backdoor corporate power grab, this globalization. And there's been a lot of bluster and myth on what's globalization. We need to cut to the chase. It's not about free trade versus protectionism. It's about who, where, and how the decisions will be made that will affect our food safety, our jobs, our quality of life, the environment in our communities, whether our kids have good schools, whether we have health care. Current corporate globalization is just one design on how to organize the world. And it's being pushed by one set of rules. And the reason I always carry around the NAFTA and the World Trade Organization agreement is to make the point. The current rules of corporate globalization, this is not free trade. This is also, despite the public relations campaigns of the special interests benefiting from this version of the rules, is not inevitable. This certainly did not come with Moses down from Mount Sinai. This is one set of rules created by one set of people. And ladies and gentlemen, in the U.S., which pushed these rules, imposed them on the rest of the world negotiations, it was 500 officially credentialed corporate advisors to the U.S. negotiators. At that time, there were 10 labor advisors, zero environment, zero health, zero for food safety, zero for human rights. Them that writes the rules, rules. And these here are the rules, the engines of this current corporate globalization. And it's not about old questions. What's being fought about here is whether there is a role for government to regulate the market to ensure the public interest. That's the bottom line of it. So when we start out this panel talking about, as Katrina did, the changes in language, we have an entire corporate deregulation, power grab, democracy cancer agenda wrapped up under a name we all like. Who's not for free trade? But ladies and gentlemen, Adam Smith and David Ricardo are rolling in their graves. This ain't free trade. That would be one page, right? This is 900 pages of corporate protectionism. In these agreements, for instance, is a 20-year monopoly worldwide for any corporation that owns a patent on a pharmaceutical. So U.S. drug prices are the highest in the world. Guess what we're going to do? We're going to protect the U.S. pharmaceutical industry to do that to the rest of the world. Meanwhile, liberalization includes cutting totally legitimate environmental, labor rights, human rights laws that for 50 years, people in the U.S. and around the world in the labor movement, in the environmental movement, in the human rights movement have struggled and died to win. So when we talk about globalization, what we're really talking about is democracy and control. And through the NAFTA and the WTO, constraints, new constraints that none of us ever voted for and would not, were imposed on our governments. Governments under these rules who are members, that for WTO is 140 governments, for instance, are in the future forbidden from distinguishing how things are made. Who here knows that under the WTO, it's an illegal trade barrier to ban a child labor product from coming into your country? You are not allowed to distinguish how something is made. A shoe is a shoe as long as it's physically a shoe. It does not matter if it was made by a kid chained to a machine or it was made in a union shop that's a co-op. All of our environmental laws, our human rights laws, our labor rights laws are based on how things are made. Who came and imposed a new rule on us that we can't have our governments look at that? Welcome to corporate rule and corporate globalization. People have heard about the famous WTO and NAFTA cases. Well, these cases have to do with a basic WTO and NAFTA rule. You know how under our current policies now, companies have to prove a product is safe before it gets in the market? Under the WTO and NAFTA, the government has to prove it's dangerous by absolute scientific certainty. So when they don't know if something is safe, they can't keep it off the market, like genetically modified foods under WTO rules. The burden of proof is on people trying to stay safe in the governments. The companies, free ride. It's new protectionism for the companies. Now, someone tell me what that has to do with trade, because I'm a trade lawyer, right? That's supposed to be about tariffs, quotas, and also treating domestic and foreign goods the same. That is not what these things are about. These are backdoor deregulatory power grabs by corporations. And next time you hear the word globalization, think slow-moving coup d'etat and democracy everywhere, because that's what really is at stake.
Lori Wallach with the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch in Washington, D.C., speaking at the Leo Beck Theater in Los Angeles. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help today from Nell Geiser and Deepa Fernandez. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. We'd like to hear from you. You can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!